Hello and welcome to Cap Answers Live. When you hear that music on a Friday, you know we're going to have some fun because that's the Weird Questions music. And Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin is what we are doing today. Jimmy Akin will be with us both hours. So I'm going to be tempted to, but I'm going to try not to give out the phone number because we take the weird questions via the internets. So people tweet them or text them or put them on Facebook or wherever, however you might get them to us via the internet. They get to Jimmy and Jimmy collects them up and we have fun reading them and finding out the answers. Jimmy Akin, of course, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Thanks for coming back for a second day in a row, Jimmy.
Hey, my pleasure, Cy Kellett.
We got some good weirdness coming up?
Yeah, sure.
That is good. That is good. Do you put a call out for these, or do these are just collected
sometimes,
over time?
Yeah. Sometimes. Occasionally I will, but people also send them in. If people are interested in sending in weird questions, they can email them to radio@catholic.com, and they'll get forwarded to me. They just need to flag them as a weird question.
Now, here's something I've never asked you before, but has a weird question ever struck you as so interesting that you made it an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
No. I do include weird questions on Mysterious World, but yeah. I haven't ever based a whole episode on one, not that I'm remembering anyway.
And today's episode, this morning's episode on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World was?
The Versailles time slip. It was an event in 1901 where two women who were visiting Versailles, France, appeared to slip back in time to the 1700s.
Like Christopher Reeve in that movie.
I haven't seen that
now
movie,
I can't think
whatever
of that.
It is.
Oh, shoot. But he slips back in time, and then he spent some time back there in the past. And then in the future, I can't remember. I think he has a coin in his pocket. From the past when he gets back. I can't remember. Something like that. Long time ago. Okay, so we got lots and lots of weird questions, Jimmy, and no calls because we've got the questions. So here's one from Emily who begins, "Hello. My daughter and son, ages 9 and 6 respectively, have a question. In Genesis, the Lord told the serpent he would have to crawl on his belly and eat dirt. Did the serpent die, or is it still around? Did its descendants have to eat dust, too? Are they still around?"
Okay, so I'm going to answer this question for you, Emily, and you can figure out the best way to present the information to your children. The account of the fall in Genesis 3 is a text that the church acknowledges uses symbolism to convey actual truth to us. And so we have to read the account in Genesis 3 on two different levels, on the symbolic level and on the ultimate truth level. On the ultimate truth level, the serpent is actually the devil. And the devil does not literally have to crawl on his belly and eat dust. That's the symbolic level. But the devil is still around. And so are, you know, demons that the devil has influenced. And so they're still around, too. You could think of them as the descendants of the devil, kind of, even though they're not his biological descendants. But on the ultimate truth level, the devil interfered with humanity very early on and was judged by God and is still around and is still a danger. Then there's the symbolic level. And the symbolic level deals with the image of the serpent. And part of what the text is doing is explaining on the symbolic level the historical hostility between humans and snakes. It seems that humans and snakes have been enemies for a long time. Even our primate ancestors seem to have an inbuilt fear of snakes that God built into them to protect them from snakes, because many snakes are dangerous, they can be venomous, they can kill you, and so they need to be aware of them. And one of the things that people have noticed about snakes is, you know, they don't have legs, so they crawl on their belly. And that's what's being described here. Also, because they crawl on their belly, their mouths are very low to the ground. And so even though people know that snakes eat things, you know, like small animals. They're predators. They'll eat mice and things like that. They also get a lot of dirt in their mouth because of how close their mouth is to the ground. You know, they, one of the things they do is they use their tongue to sense the environment around them, and they'll stick out their tongue and flick it up and down. Well, it's going to get dirty, and so they're going to end up pulling dirt into their mouth. And that's also something that the text is drawing on. It's the fact that snakes are very low to the ground. They will get dust in their mouths. And this is being used symbolically to portray humiliation. Because if you're forced to crawl in the dust and you're forced by how low your mouth is to eat dust, that's a very humiliating thing, or it would be for a human. And so that becomes a symbol of the humiliation of the serpent on the symbolic level of the text. And obviously the original serpent is just a symbol. So he was a symbol of the devil. So there wasn't a literal biological serpent at this time, but obviously there are descendants. There are lots of literal biological serpents around today.
All right. But Emily did not end her questioning there. She's got one from herself as well. So Emily goes on to say, I also have a question. How would a Catholic time lord know when to go to Mass to fulfill the Sunday obligation? Are all the incarnations of the Doctor married to Riversong, or just the 11th Doctor? Given that they both time traveled separately and could conceivably encounter each other at any point in time and space, at what point would he be considered a widower?
Okay, so the answer to the first part of the question about how a Catholic time lord would know when to go to Mass to fulfill the Sunday obligation, the answer is the same as for a traveler today, because today we have travel that is very rapid. You know, you can get on a plane and go from one time zone to another very quickly. And the answer that we use today would be the same as for a time lord. You honor the local time. So if you're a time lord and you materialize on a Sunday, you're going to need to go to Mass, either that or leave this time zone. In terms of the second question about the marriage of the Doctor to Riversong, so marriage is an agreement to live as husband and wife, you know, for the rest of your lives. And that's something that comes into existence at a certain point in time. When the marriage ceremony occurs, the parties exchange consent to be husband and wife, and that happened in the episode The Wedding of Riversong, where the Doctor and Riversong exchanged matrimonial consent, and so they would be married from that point forward, even after Matt Smith's 11th Doctor regenerated. And we see evidence of that with Peter Capaldi's 12th Doctor in the Christmas special, The Husbands of Riversong, where Peter Capaldi's 12th Doctor clearly still regards himself as married to Riversong. And so if Riversong shows up for any later incarnations of the Doctor who are men, they would still be married, presumably. What about the earlier incarnations, though, the ones before Matt Smith's 11th Doctor? Well, that would be kind of like time traveling here in our lives and meeting your spouse before they had given matrimonial consent to you. So like if you, Emily, went back in time and met your husband when he was a teenager, he wouldn't be your husband yet, but you'd still have affection for him. And you might even say, yeah, that's my husband. Meaning that's the man who's going to exchange matrimonial consent with me one day. And in fact, Riversong has met multiple incarnations of the Doctor prior to Matt Smith's 11th Doctor. If you listen to the Big Finish audio dramas that star the actors from the original series, Riversong at times is even desperate to meet one of her husband's former selves just to be comforted by him in a tense situation, but she doesn't cross the line fully and regard herself as in a husband and wife relationship with the prior doctors. Although with the 10th doctor, since she did meet the 10th doctor and flirted with him, she'll still flirt with the 10th doctor. Oh, in terms of when the bond would cease, this gets a little complicated because of time travel, but Riversong died in Silence in the Library, and specifically part two of that, Forest of the Dead. And so now she just exists as a computer program and is not married to anybody.
Emily, two very, very fine sets of questions for Jimmy. But guess what? Emily's not done. Well, she's done for a minute. We got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin, Emily's final question, and then more from others right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
How are you listening to EWTN Radio right now? Have you ever wished you could listen on a local radio station? Maybe our Lord is speaking to your heart to help make that happen. Don't let a lack of experience hold you back. Find out how you can help start a Catholic radio station where you live. Powered by the truth of the church and EWTN's dynamic radio programming. Email Steve at this address, radio@EWTN.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, the all-Emily show today. Well, it's not actually the all-Emily show today, but thus far it's been all questions from Emily. It's weird questions with Jimmy Akin this hour, and all the questions are in, and they are weird, and this one comes also from Emily. Finally, she says, and most importantly, Jimmy Akin, how do you store information in your brain? Do you have a photographic memory? Have you been partially assimilated or turned into a Cyberman, allowing you to call to mind detailed information at will? How exactly do you store the plethora of the facts and data that you keep in your head?
Okay, so I have not been partially assimilated or turned into a Cyberman in the Doctor Who sense. I am technically, you could consider me a cyborg because I do have lenses in my eyes that bend and adapt to the muscles in the eyes, so they're movable parts. I had them put in when I had my cataracts taken out, but that didn't affect my brain in any way. In terms of how I remember stuff, there's actually, now you say, how do I store information in my brain? There's actually a debate in parapsychology about whether or to what extent we store information in our brain. There is some indication that we may have at least auxiliary storage functions outside of our brain. Having said that, people seem to think I have a good memory, although to me it is nothing but frustratingly inadequate. You mentioned, you know, what are called photographic memories, and that's a popular term that you hear used, but it is not one that has a great deal of it has a kind of complicated story when it comes to the scientific study of so-called photographic memories. Another term that you'll hear for photographic memory is eidetic memory, and that comes from the Greek word eidos, which means a visible image or form. And so eidetic memory or photographic memory is the ability to remember images that you're presented with. And children tend to have this to some degree. Nobody has it perfectly. It also, there's some evidence it can fade by adulthood, but I do have at least a partially eidetic memory. If I read something, for example, I may remember an image of the part of the page where I read it. But it's not necessarily enough to conjure a photograph mentally of it. I'll just remember it was on the lower left-hand part of the page or something like that. There's another kind of memory which is known as hyperthymesia, and it's also called highly superior autobiographical memory. This is a very rare phenomenon. There have only been 61 people who were diagnosed with hyperthymesia. As the alternative name, highly superior autobiographical memory suggests, people with this condition have a very, very good memory for autobiographical incidents. They will remember their own life experiences in incredible detail. And you'll also notice I said people diagnosed with this condition. That's because it has negative consequences. If you have crystal clear memories of your past previous events in your life, you can dwell on them and you can get trapped in remembering things that happened because you're unable to forget them. And so some of the people who have this condition actually struggle a lot because their memory is functioning in a way it's not supposed to. Also, just because they have highly superior autobiographical memories doesn't mean they have great memories for everything else. If you give them an abstract thing to remember, like say a long number, well, they'll remember the incident where you gave them that number, but they may not remember the number at all. Autobiographical memories, and they actually can turn out poorer than average on standard memory tests. But they will remember the incidents really well, but they won't necessarily remember abstract information well. So when it comes to remembering abstract information, which is what I think people tend to notice about me, a common way that people do that is by using mnemonic devices. Mnemonic devices are mental techniques to memorize and recall information. A famous one that we even published a book about here at Catholic Answers is using memory theaters, sometimes called also memory castles or mind palaces. But you imagine walking through a building that you know well, and you associate different pieces of information with different items in that house. For example, if you imagine walking through your own house, let's say the first thing you encounter is a doormat, you know, because you wipe your feet off when you come home. And so you might associate a piece of information with the doormat. Like if someone wants you to remember the word pizza, you might imagine there's a pizza laying on your doormat. And then when you want to recall this information, you can just walk through your house and see the associated images, and that'll remind you of the information you're supposed to remember. I do not do this. I don't use mnemonic devices of that sort. What I occasionally do is, because I spend a lot of time in front of the computer researching and writing, is if I'm away from my computer and there's something I need to remember, I will imagine it in front of my computer screen. And then when I come back to my computer, I'll remember that thing because I have a mental image of it right in front of my computer screen. But that's a kind of exceptional situation for when I'm away from the computer. I don't use that to remember things on an ongoing basis. One thing that may have an influence on my memory is a condition known as synesthesia. Synesthesia is the association of two different types of sensory information. A very famous form of synesthesia is known as grapheme color synesthesia. A grapheme is something you write, like a letter or a number, and color is obviously different. So some synesthetes, people who have synesthesia, will associate letters and numbers with colors. That's one form of synesthesia, but there are many, many others. I happen to have several forms of synesthesia, so I'm what's known as a polysynesthete. And one of the types I have is is grapheme color synesthesia. So I associate letters and numbers with colors. And it's just automatic. As soon as I think of a word and how it's spelled, I instantly see the colors even before – it's not like I'm trying to remember them. I just instantly see them even before I can name them. So like Cy, your two-letter name, C-Y, is yellow and medium blue. And I see that as soon as I think of the word Cy – without having to concentrate to remember those. There appears to be some tie between synesthesia and memory, to where synesthetes may be relying on their condition to help them remember things. I know, for example, in the past, I have consciously used it to, for example, remember numbers. Like if I'm trying to remember the number 1334, in my synesthesia, that's white, purple, purple, seafoam, green. And so if I need to remember 1334, I can just remember those colors and then rededuce when I need to call up the number. Okay, so it's white, purple, purple, seafoam, green. That's 1334. And so I can use a kind of mnemonic device that way. And there's some suggestion that synesthetes may, in addition to being able to consciously do that, may be kind of using it subconsciously as well. So that could be happening. Mm-hmm. I do seem to have a well-developed memory for certain types of things. One of the things that I do, as people may know, is different types of dance calling. Like I call square dances, I call English country dances, and so on. And that, in the case of English country dances, you need to be able to remember all of the moves in the dance, and name them in time with the music, so that the dancers know what and when to do them. And I have a very easy time remembering all the moves in a dance. I seem to have an easier time than other English country dance callers. In square dancing, at least in modern Western square dancing, the choreography is extemporaneous. So it's being made up as you call it. And the way I do that is I use a technique known as modular calling, where I have pre-memorized bits of choreography that I combine kind of like Legos on the fly. And so I'll remember the short sequences of calls and stitch them together as I go. And this is not the technique that most square dance callers use. They use a technique known as sight calling, where they watch what the dancers are doing and figure out a next move based on the position they're in.
Oh.
I can do that, but I use it as a backup. And many sight callers say they don't want to use modular calling because of the amount of memory involved. But it's the natural way for me to do it. So it seems easier for me. I have a lot of success with it. But I definitely don't remember everything. What I've noticed is I remember the things that are important to me. And an illustration of this that I sometimes cite is a phone call I got from my friend Stephen Gradonis a number of years ago. And he called me and he had some moral question he wanted my analysis of. And so I didn't remember ever considering this moral question before, but I start thinking my way through it and talking my way through it. And I arrived at an answer over the phone. And he said, "Good, because that's the same thing you said 5 years ago." And I had no memory of our previous phone call.
Wow.
Because it wasn't a highly important thing to me to remember. But I rededuced the same answer from the same data 5 years later. So I definitely don't remember everything. One area where I know we have someone at Catholic Answers who does better than me is Tim Staples. Tim Staples has done a lot of work on remembering individual Bible verses. The citation,
yeah.
Like Romans 2:20. 20 or whatever. I made a conscious choice years ago that I wasn't going to try to remember the specific Bible verses for a lot of passages. There are some I use so often that I remember them. But Tim Staples has done a, I wanted to focus on not memorizing, but learning large quantities of scripture rather than the addresses of specific verses. But Tim has done that work, and he's actually better than I am when it comes to remembering the address of a specific verse.
Emily, thank you for lots of great questions to start us off on Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. More weird questions coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live. What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is 25 years old. That's a quarter century helping people come into deeper communion with the Catholic faith. As we move into our second quarter century, please help us reach thousands more by becoming a Society 315 monthly donor. Right now, when you join Society 315 at a monthly giving level of $25 or more, we've added some extra perks to the other great benefits we already offer members. Go to givecatholic.com and choose the monthly option to start your donation.
As a child, the great theologian Thomas Aquinas asked, "What is God?" Best-selling author Kevin Vost's new book follows the mature thought of Aquinas in answering that question. In clear and approachable fashion, What is God examines God's attributes and considers questions about him that have vexed mankind for centuries. Order your copy of What is God today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Monday on More to Life, rest for the weary.
Is burnout getting the best of you? We'll help you get re-energized.
That's Monday on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. That's our Weird Questions music. Jimmy Akin here for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on this Friday afternoon here at Catholic Answers. Thank you very much for being with us. We do appreciate that you take the time to be with us. Next weird question comes from Stephen. Stephen asks this. A news story described a couple that discovered they were not legally married because after the service was performed, the marriage license was not sent to the proper civil department, so they needed to have a new civil wedding. Question one, if this happens with a Catholic wedding, would anything need to be done when fixing the civil side?
So in that situation, you had a Catholic wedding and presumably the form that the priest filled out or the deacon filled out got sent, but then it got lost. And so it never got turned into the right department for the civil registrar of marriages. From a Catholic point of view, the marriage was valid when you guys exchanged matrimonial consent in front of a priest. So you wouldn't need to get remarried in the Catholic Church in order to fix the civil side of things. You could, in that situation, just go down to the courthouse and have a civil wedding because you're already married in the eyes of the Catholic Church. So you wouldn't need to do anything on that front.
Okay, so the second part of the question, because this is a two-part, we're getting several multi-part questions to start out. My computer's glitched on me. Okay, two. What if there is a clerical error with a Catholic wedding and the needed notation is not made in the church baptism records? How would that be fixed?
Okay, so in that case, you're still married to the person from the moment you exchange matrimonial consent in front of the church's officiant and the witnesses. And if for some reason this didn't get written down in the parish records the way it's supposed to be, then the and if the priest, you know, has not thought to record it, the way that it would typically be handled, I assume, would be just by taking statements from the witnesses. That's the point. Let's say the priest dies before he writes it down. Well, that's part of why the witnesses are there. Case there's a problem with the priest, you can go back to the witnesses, and you need to have, you know, two witnesses for the marriage. And so you can go back to the witnesses and have them testify, yes, I was there, this did happen, it was on this date, and you can reestablish it that way.
All right. Stephen, thanks. Appreciate the weird questions. Let's see. Next up is Catherine. And Catherine.
By the way, the role of the witnesses that I just articulated of being legal witnesses to this is certain because we didn't used to have witnesses. You could have a private marriage with no priest and no witnesses there. And that was legal for a long time. These were known as secret marriages or sometimes clandestine marriages. There's in the movie Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, Steve Martin is romantically attracted to a woman, and we hear him narrating. He's kissing her at one point in the movie after they've developed a romance, and he says in narration, my plan was to maneuver her over to the bed, marry her, and then start the whoopee machine. And the thing is, back in the day, you could do exactly that. You didn't have to have a church wedding or anything like that. You could get romantically involved with someone, maneuver them over to the bed, say the vows, and you were married. But there was a morning after effect where people the next day did not always want to regard, I don't know that I was really serious about that. And that's why the church got involved in this and demanded a minister and two witnesses so that you couldn't have people lying about it afterwards.
You can imagine that there were some broken hearts in the morning. All right, this one comes from Catherine. If Jesus died once and for all and rose from the dead, if there are other planets that support life created in his image and likeness, how did we get so lucky that it all happened on our planet? Or do we need to spread the good news to all the ends of the universe?
Well, we may need to, you know, evangelize other races. We'll have to wait until we meet those races to find out. But if they display a consciousness of sin and we tell them about Jesus and they respond and want to be baptized, then, yeah, we would need to evangelize that race. There may be other races that don't need evangelization because they never fell into sin the way ours did. Mm-hmm. But Catherine is making an assumption that Jesus incarnated only here on Earth. And we don't know that. We don't know what goes on other planets. We don't know if there are other intelligent creatures in the universe. The odds are pretty good that there are somewhere. But God could incarnate among them if he chose, because he's omnipotent. And just because you've incarnated once doesn't mean that you are thereby blocked from being able to incarnate a second time. If you can incarnate once, you can incarnate any number of times you choose. And so by divine omniscience, Jesus could have incarnated on multiple planets and redeemed multiple races, or God could have provided some other way for their redemption. So it may be that we are on a unique planet that is the only one God ever incarnated on. but it may not be as well. We'll have to leave that in God's hands.
Catherine, great question. Thank you very much. That fit the category just perfectly. Lots of weird questions today because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on this Friday. And Kevin asks this. What would have happened if just Eve had eaten the apple and not Adam or vice versa?
We don't know. The church doesn't have a definite teaching on this. It seems that there would be a few possibilities. One possibility is, so the idea is that Adam, one possibility is sometimes called the federal headship model. And the idea is that Adam represented the federal head of our race, so that what Adam did was determinative of what would happen to the rest of our race. And if that model focused on Adam is correct, then Adam had to eat the fruit in order for, or whatever the original act was, in order to cause the race to fall into sin. And on that model, if Eve had eaten but not Adam, then the race would not have fallen. However, the federal headship model focused on Adam is not the only one. You could say that they're both co-equally the heads of our race, and if either one of them is subject to sin, then that blocks the transmission of sanctifying grace to their descendants, and therefore the line falls into original sin. So on that model, if Eve alone ate the fruit and Adam did not, Adam would not have fallen, but all of Eve's descendants would have. And so since they both ate, we're all fallen, and we know that, but we don't really know what would have happened if only one of them had eaten. That's a question we have to leave open. But there are some different possibilities.
All right. Kevin, thank you very much. This perfect time for a break, so we'll take a break right here. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We'll be right back with more Fun Friday right after this.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. And you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Marcus Grody and his son John Mark talk about the journey home.
How do I feel about passing the baton to my son? I am very excited about that.
It's weird to be stepping into my dad's role here. I'm humbled and honored, obviously, by the privilege and by his confidence in EWTN's and the audiences. In some sense, this is something I've been around all my life.
The journey continues on The Journey Home, Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern, only on EWTN Radio and Television.
Love that music. That is the Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin music. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And all the questions are in, so just sit back and relax and enjoy them. And this one comes from Elisa, who asks, well, she has a kind of a little story question. A woman gets married, then transported back in time 400-ish years, thinking she'll never make it back to her own time. And because she needs to be married for protection, she gets married, despite the fact that she was married in her original time. Is the new marriage valid?
So, Sai, you commented on the story aspect of this. And if I'm not mistaken, the story is based on something that happens in the TV show Outlander, where like someone goes back in time several centuries in Scotland.
Right.
I've never seen Outlander, so I don't know for sure, but it sounds like what I've heard about Outlander.
Yeah. That makes sense.
The answer is theologically undefined. Current theology is built on marriage is built on the fact that the two people are living in the same time zone and are not able to freely travel in time. So you're kind of locked in to the time period that you were born in. And so we haven't had the need theologically to develop complex, scenarios involving time travel into the past. We will have a need for that if we ever develop time travel into the past. But right now, at the level of doctrinal development we're at right now and the level of theological development we're at right now, we don't have certain answers. But I think it's possible to at least sketch some answers, because we do have one kind of time travel right now, which is time travel into the future. That happens constantly. We're all constantly moving into the future at a rate of 1 second per second in our native frame of reference. Now, you can change your native, and we know how marriage works in that situation. If one of the spouses dies, the other spouse is then free. Okay, so is it possible to travel into the future at a rate faster than 1 second per second? And as we learned by 1915 from Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, the answer is yes. There's a famous thought experiment known as Einstein's twin paradox. It turns out that the passage of time for you in your frame of reference will slow down if you move faster or if you go deeper into a gravity well. And so what happens in Einstein's twin paradox is you have two twins. They're born at the same time on Earth in the same frame of reference, but then one of them gets on a ship that goes fast. It accelerates at an appreciable fraction of the speed of light. So time on that ship slows down, and then the ship turns around and comes back. And when the twin who got on board the ship steps out, he's going to be younger than the twin that stayed behind on Earth, because the twin that stayed behind on Earth didn't travel fast. So time proceeded for him at the normal 1 second per second rate, but the one that got on the ship had a much slower passage of time. And so he might be years or even decades younger than the twin that was left behind. And we've actually proven this has happened because airplanes travel fast, and they put atomic clocks on airplanes and tested this out. And yes, it's true. If you accelerate, you will have your frame of reference slow down with respect to the passage of time. And they've done Einstein's twin paradox with two atomic clocks.
How did they
get one of them? They put on the airplane, one of them they leave behind.
How do you get an atomic clock through security? I can't even get a bottle of water through security.
They had special permission.
Oh, okay.
So if you proceed into the future, let's say you go 400 years into the future and step off the spaceship, your prior spouse is dead. You are now free. You know, you're 400 years in the future, your spouse is dead, and you have no way of going back to the past. You should regard yourself as free. So that, I think, is certain. And it may give us an indication, if we flip the arrow of time and say, okay, if you traveled 400 years into the past and had no possibility of returning to the present, your spouse in the present is not yet born, and therefore you're not bound to that person. Now, what changes all this is if you have the possibility of return. If from 400 years in the future you could come back to the present, you might still be bound to that person. Yeah. If you travel 400 years into the past, but you can return, you might still be bound to that person. So as a simplifying assumption, I'm assuming there's no return. But if you travel to a time where your spouse is no longer alive or not yet alive, and you have no way of getting back to them, then the assumption would be you're not bound to them.
Alisa, what a cool question. Apparently from a cool TV show. So thank you very, very much. Kevin asks this, Jimmy. Deja vu. What is it? Why does it happen?
Well, deja vu is the experience of feeling like you've been through an experience before. It seems familiar. There are several related concepts in French, but they're not as well known. In deja vu, you know, you might walk into a room and think, I've been here before, mm-hmm. when your conscious memory is saying you've never been here before. So what causes it? Well, there are multiple causes. Some of the causes are pathological. For example, temporal lobe epilepsy is associated with deja vu. And temporal lobe epilepsy can be caused by traumatic brain injury. So if you get hit in the head with something really strongly and you develop temporal lobe epilepsy as a result, you may experience an anomalous amount of deja vu. Also, migraines, where a person sees auras, are also associated with deja vu. So if you have migraines with auras, you may have an anomalously large amount of deja vu. And in both of these situations, the explanation is presumably something pathological. But there are lots of cases where people who don't have a pathological condition experience deja vu. And so there are also clearly non-pathological causes for this phenomenon. One that has been proposed is sometimes called split perception. As we navigate through life, our senses are taking in lots of information about our environment, and that information needs to be processed, and it's in order to be presented to our conscious mind. And we have different modules in our subconscious that process different bits of information. And to some degree, these are associated with different parts of the brain. Like at the back of our head, we have a visual center that processes visual information. We also have an auditory center that processes sound. And so according to the split perception theory of deja vu, what happens is as this information is being processed, it gets split into two channels. And for one reason or another, one of the channels takes longer to process than the other does.
Oh.
And so, yeah. So part of the impression you get of your experience is processed quickly, and you go, oh, here I'm having this experience. And then a fraction of a second later, the other part of the signal catches up, and it's like, wait, I already had this.
I have been here before.
Yeah. And that's a suggestion for what may be causing non-pathological deja vu, but we're not sure. Another thing that is a likely cause of deja vu, and I think this one is certain, is a phenomenon known as cryptomnesia. And cryptomnesia is where you learned or experienced something and you just don't remember it. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, Psy.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you first learned the word apple?
Not a clue. No,
not a clue.
I do not remember.
You would have learned that in childhood, and it's been buried by childhood amnesia, which is its own known memory phenomenon. We forget things in early childhood because of childhood amnesia. Well, it's also, in this case, an example of cryptomnesia, where you know something, you know the meaning of the word apple, but you do not remember learning it. And cryptomnesia, I think, is responsible for a lot of deja vu, where people have experienced either the identical thing or something very similar before.
Right.
But they can't consciously remember when it was. But subconsciously, they're picking up on the similarities between the different situations. One form that cryptomnesia may take is based on dreams, because we have lots of experiences in dreams and we're programmed to forget them. That's why it's so rare. I mean, we spend, you know, a huge chunk of our life dreaming, and we very rarely remember our dreams. It's we're actually programmed to forget so that our memories are not clogged up with loads of confabulation. And so it could be that the prior experience you had is something that you experienced in a dream, and you no longer remember that dream, but you subconsciously pick up on the fact that your current waking experience is similar to what happened in the dream, and that could be responsible for deja vu. Another possibility that has gotten proposed is precognition. If psychic functioning exists, and if the form of psychic functioning known as precognition exists, which actually was supported by St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, they both thought precognition was real. Then maybe you're picking up on you've previously picked up on this experience. You saw it precognitively, and that's why it seems familiar, because you've already had a precognitive experience of what's happening, and now that you're actually there, it seems familiar to you. A sort of final possibility, or two final possibilities that sometimes get proposed, are past life memories. In the world, there are a significant number of people who believe in reincarnation, and it's been proposed that that may explain deja vu if in a prior life you had a particular experience that's like your current experience. That past life memory, which is normally subconscious, may be triggering, hey, I've been here before, I've done this. And so past life memories are a possibility, if past lives are real. Now, the Christian faith says past lives are not real. So how else might one explain past life memories? Well, in parapsychology, there is a serious proposal that would explain apparent past life memories, in terms of psychic functioning, and specifically a psychic ability that's the flip side of precognition. Precognition lets you envision things that will happen in the future. Retrocognition enables you to learn about things that happened in the past. And so retrocognition might be the explanation for past life memories, and it might be the explanation for deja vu. If you walk into a situation and it feels familiar, you may be having a view of the same site or the same situation in the past retrocognitively. So that's kind of a sketch of the different options for explaining deja vu, the pathological ones, the natural but non-pathological ones, and the paranormal ones.
Thank you very much for that question, Kevin. I hope that was helpful to you. You know, Jimmy, I just want to add a question to what he asked, because why do we forget our childhood? I mean, the earliest years of our childhood. I mean, some people can maybe go back to when they were three, I guess. Maybe even earlier. I've never heard of that, but maybe.
I don't know that I have a definitive answer for that, but there are some possibilities. One is what's probably true is we need to prepare the brain for future learning, because embarking on a new phase of life, and we have this explosive growth of neurons and neural connections when we're first learning our language, and then they get pruned back in order to prepare for a new phase of growth. And childhood amnesia may be part of that pruning process to get us ready and configured for the next phase of life.
Got it. Kevin, again, thank you very, very much for the question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. That's always a lot of fun for two reasons. One, we get that cool, weird music. And two, Jimmy Akin is here with us answering weird questions. So no phone calls today. No need to dial. We've got the questions in front of us. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy them. And right now, they've got double rewards over at shop.catholic.com. So if you are in the reward program, go ahead and get double rewards until February 7th. If you're not in the reward program, go ahead and join. You too will get the double rewards until February 7th on everything that you purchase over at shop.catholic.com. And when you get those reward points, save them up, use them to get more stuff. shop.catholic.com. We're going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.